Hello, everyone. It's a pleasure to see you here today, and I'm very excited to introduce Nick the Unbosser, and we will be diving into a very pertinent topic of people and culture, which, as we know, is one of the enablers for an operating model. And even more exciting, Nick is going to take us through the doubts and sacrifices on the path to business harmony. Nick, I'd like you to introduce yourself because I can go on for hours. How inspirational you are, how you launched this movement of unbossing, how much research you've done traveling around all sorts of countries for your book. But let's hear from you. Tell us, who is Nick?
Who is Nick? I'm 41. I'm located in Antwerp, Belgium. I am an entrepreneur. I've had a couple of successes, but mainly my failures helped me define and identify who I truly am. And I was a partner in a private equity fund, and then I had a quite a personal what's the word in English? A personal low point on the private side. My wife and I, we were trying to have children, and it didn't work. And that was in the beginning quite sad, but in many ways it was one of the most enriching experiences in my life as well. And that kind of launched me on this path of discovery and a journey throughout the entire Middle East and trying to understand where our society and the foundations of our society comes from. And that all resulted, so both my journey through many organizations, on the one hand, my personal experiences and my journey throughout the biblical stories and the foundations of our society led to a book that I'm going to publish end of the year. So yeah, that's, I hope, in a nutshell who I am.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for sharing this experience. And we will dive deeper into the premise of the book and also the Unbossers network that is operating very successfully. And let us start with the book. And it's a very curious and unusual blend of spirituality and business. And you say in your book that the survival of the fittest theory causes us to see peers as competitors, causes us to see bullish managers as successful, and we accept very often immorality when it leads to higher profits. This is the sad truth, and that leads to distrust in the workplace. It makes people doubt, you know, many existential questions. And most of all, am I in the right place? Am I working for the right company? So how did you find the courage and the knowledge to blend this spiritual beginning with the business necessity of today's?
I'm still trying to figure that out, actually. So, before I started studying biblical theology about 7 years ago, I had many experiences in many different organizations on the one hand, and also experimented with basically anything you can do in the area of personal development and coaching and spirituality. And I was kind of at a point that I thought, I think I figured it out. I think I know how the world works. I think I know what organizations need. And then, as I mentioned in my introduction, you get slammed in the face with a challenge from life, being the basic assumption that you will always be a father. And then at one moment in your life, that's just boom, that goes away. And that That challenge is, by the way, as old as the street. In the biblical stories, there are many people who are struggling to have children. And that somehow drove me and my wife to have many deep conversations about life. And in one of those conversations, I'm not a religious person at all. I don't think you can be brought up with more resistance to anything that's organized religion than I have. But my wife, she went to a religious school. So she was kind of brought up with the prayers and things like that. She's not a practical religious person, but she knows the drill. And so in one of those conversations in a small church, by the way, in Italy, I asked her, could you share with me the prayer of the Holy Father? And so she did. And I started reflecting on the words. And after a couple of days, I shared my interpretation of the meaning. And when I told my interpretation, I saw a spark in her eyes. And she said to me, it's the first time, although for 18 years, I repeated this poem for three times a day. It's the first time that kind of the meaning of a potential meaning was opened up to me. And the only thing I did was seeing parallels between the words and what I experienced in my life and in my organizations. And that kind of pushed the spark in the eyes of my wife, that kind of pushed me to say, maybe I should start reading these texts. And then I started reading the text and a lot of psychological analysis and theological analysis. And the more I got drew into the stories and the more I learned about it, the more the parallels between the experiences of the people in the stories and the experiences and my observations that I see in organizations started to match with each other. And that's also why I start the book with a quote, which is 2,500 years old, and I'm paraphrasing, but basically says, there's nothing new under the sun. Everything goes, everything comes, everything goes. And every time we think there's something new, it's just because we have forgotten it has always been there. And that is really the case. At one moment in time, I really could see every challenge in organizations, I could map it to challenges that were already written down for centuries, millennia, in stories of other people. So the world maybe has changed, but we as human beings, we are still the same and we face the same struggles no matter what the context is. And so that led me to writing a book about it.
How very interesting, and what a story. I am going to give you a test, because I'm still struggling to connect how are the business challenges relevant to the Bible. And of course, we work in the space of customer centricity, which really is human centricity. The challenge that I'd like you to think about is that many organizations declare their customer-centric intent, but many struggle to live their purpose. Why do you think this happens, and what can help them take the first steps towards customer-centric operating model and culture based on your biblical stories and
first
philosophy?
I'm going to answer it immediately. First, two caveats. The first one is, I would invite everyone who's listening to let go, just for this one session, let go any conviction, any belief, any conceptualization that you have about the Bible and its influence in our society. And just for this session, look at it from its most basic form. It's just a collection of texts about love, war, peace, power, failure, meaning, basically all aspects of life, written by our ancestors who lived in the Middle East between 3,000 and 2,000 years old. And the texts themselves were written and rewritten over a period of more than 1,000 years, which it should be astonishing to us, because in our society, we have the attention span to read two tweets. at that moment in history, they were reading these large texts and writing and rewriting them over generations. So that's it's just a collection of texts, nothing more, nothing less. Okay.
So for the purpose of this conversation, we're treating the Bible not as a theological book,
no,
but as an exploration of human history and
behavior. Yeah, it's just those people, those authors at the time, they described what they think is the way towards a good life. Okay. Second caveat, even though I've studied organizations for 15 years, biblical theology for 7 years, quite obsessively, if I may say so. At some point in the journey, my wife doubted if I was ever going to come out of the rabbit hole. But that being said, I still scratch the surface. But I still don't know anything, you know? So, there's one thing I know for sure, and that's within the span of my life, I don't have enough time to grasp the full meaning of dynamics in an organization, nor all the insights that are buried in those stories. Okay, so I'm talking from a humble place. I don't know anything, all right? Coming back to your question, why do organizations struggle when they declare customer centricity to actually apply it? Well, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, meaning that simply declaring your intention is not enough. When you communicate such big promises, one first needs to consider whether you are ready to embrace the consequences of that which you are declaring. And I will give you a very simple real life example. So in our Ambassadors Network from the beginning, I organize a lot of workshops with Daddy Kate. This is a printing company. The Belgian printing business has shrunk in the past decades with 50%. Okay. 99% of the printing companies chose a strategy of cost efficiency, which is basically the main strategy in most organizations. We want to be as efficient and as cost optimized as possible. Dedicate, despite the shrinking of the business, they grew year after year with a radical, almost religious, and there's a first link with the Bible, a religious belief in customer centricity, meaning that despite rational elements, despite contra-intuitive feelings, they had the faith that in this business, they could build an organization which was customer-centric, more expensive than the competition, and still sustainable, successful. Okay, so it's almost a religion. One of the consequences they had to pay, and they're willing to pay for this customer-centric approach, is that they are not always the most efficient factory. So whenever they get a call from a customer, they will say yes, and then figure it out how they will try to meet those needs. And that means that sometimes a running printing job has to be stopped. New inked patterns have to be put in the machine to make sure that that customer is served first, and then the former job can be reset and start again. In a cost-efficient factory, that would be impossible. It would be insane to do that. You want to print as many volumes at the lowest price possible. But Dedicate says that is the consequence, one of the consequences that we are willing to embrace, that sometimes we are less efficient in order to be extremely customer-centric. So did you also ask what I could advise to organizations, or did I miss that?
Yes. And I think one of the advices that is already coming out is define your purpose, define how you're going to be customer-centric. And in case of Dedicate that you've just shared with us, they said, we will do our best to tailor to meet whatever the customer, whatever the complexity of the job. We're going to cater to non-standard tailored jobs in the best way possible. And they stuck to the strategy throughout the times. So I hear a lot of things here is belief, dedication, and continuity. Am I hearing this right? What other advice is
being given? Well, there's the amazing link with the characters in the biblical stories is that the way you show that you stick to your strategy is by the sacrifices you make to implement it. So what I've noticed in the biblical stories is that the human characters, it's a pattern that repeats all over the stories, that the human characters have to sacrifice something that on the one hand they love, and on the other hand is holding them back to fulfill their full potential. And so the question is, are they willing to sacrifice that which they love, but that which is holding and also back to realizing their full potential? And there seems to be a correlation between the weight of the sacrifice and the scale of the potential that is being realized. So the more difficult the sacrifice, the more potential is being realized. And we see this in the story of Abraham, who has to sacrifice his son. We see this in the story of Mary, who gives birth to a son, although she knows the grueling destiny that awaits him. We see it in the story of Jesus, who sacrifices his own life. But in all the many characters, just three examples, but in many characters, you see this pattern coming back. And I observe something very similar in organizations. And I'll give you again a very clear example. So since this year, I'm also organizing for the companies in our network workshops with Klaas Arians from ABN AMRO. So Klaas led for the past 7 years a 3,500 employee department, which was the consumer side of the bank. Now we're talking a 200-year-old bank here, right? Very famous in the Netherlands. And in 7 years, they became a 100% digital, anytime, anywhere, customer-centric banking service model. Now, the results after 7 years are fascinating. They cut cost by 30%. Their transactional NPS went through the roof, same like their total revenue. But in order to get there, they had to make many, many, many sacrifices. And I'll give you three examples. The first one, well, Klaas, in order to implement his vision of this fully digital, anywhere, anytime banking service to his consumers, he had to be willing to sacrifice his own job. Because few people in the organization believed him. And if this transformation failed, this would have meant his job. And keep in mind, he was working for 25 years in the company. He climbed the corporate ladder. He was just below the executive team. And he had to be willing to sacrifice his job, willing to sacrifice it when it would fail in order to have a chance on success. So that's the first thing. Secondly, in order to create an organization structure that was flexible, agile, and focused on mastering the skills required to meet the consumer's need, and don't fall off your chairs, ladies and gentlemen, they sacrificed 250 managers of the 275. So these managers were either paid out to leave the company or repositioned to another department. Why? Because Klaas knew if we don't sacrifice these managers, the frontline workers will never get to the level of mastery to what our consumers need, because they will always fall back on what managers think. So we wanted to give the full responsibility to the frontline to become masters in serving customers. And then lastly, in order to become fully digital, same logic, they had to sacrifice more than 1,000 brick and mortar bank offices. So where customers could go to physically. And he said, because as long as we have a lot of these offices all around the country, I give an excuse to consumers and to our employees to sit physically together. And so you can imagine, it even came in the media, you can imagine the resistance that came with that change. But those were the sacrifices that they needed to make to now, 7-8 years later, be this extremely customer-centric organization with all the results that come with it. And tying that back to the first question, declaration of intention and action, if you're not willing to make the sacrifices that are needed to become a customer-centric organization, my advice is maybe leave the intention away.
You have to be very brave and believe, as you say.
Extremely brave. Yeah, and that's where we have corporate leaders, for example, Paul Van Ooyen, who explicitly states, this is a religion. It's like a religion. It's, you have to have the faith, even though that the rational elements, the numbers are maybe not yet supporting it. You have to have to make the leap of faith simply because you don't have any other option. There's, in your mind, for Klaas, there was no other option. For Tess, for Dedicate, there was no other option. Their entire mind, their heart, their body was only heading in one way, and that was the customer-centric way. It's not because it was the best strategy. It was simply because it was the only strategy that they could envision for their company.
And does it always come from the leader? You know, the way you describe this is that you have to have a single individual who passionately believes in it and is then able to lead others on their journey, on their path. So does it take a single individual? And if it does, what does it take to lead everyone else? I imagine ABN AMRO were not thrilled to follow the path of sacrifices if the people were not on the same agenda.
Well, this is so first and foremost, Klaas, for example, he was not the CEO of the bank, right? He was not even in the executive team. So do you need leader/CEO? Well, there's the example, no. And there's another reason why I feel there's an over attention on the role of leaders in the change of organizations. And we also overestimate the power they have. Yes, they have hierarchical power, but in the many conversations that I had, it's very clear to me that they often feel powerless when it comes to trying to implement their ideas. And I think we should focus much more on the concept of shared responsibility. And I'll give you again an example. I think we all agree in a customer-centric organization, immediate feedback, both from the customer to the company as within the teams, is crucial. Now, imagine, Olga, that we are working in a global corporate with an HQ in the States, a global CEO there, and we are working in a small marketing team somewhere in Belgium. There's only so much that the global CEO in the States can do to make me give immediate feedback to you. But what I can do, I can take the responsibility if I see you chasing deadlines, chasing emails, chasing meetings, I can step up and say, hey, Olga, I think you're maybe a little bit too busy to be able to concentrate and be creative. How can I help? And so my direct impact and my ability to give you direct feedback and have therefore direct impact on you is much bigger than any global CEO in an HQ in the US can have. So I truly believe it's a shared responsibility, and there are more elements of a customer-centric behavior that anyone listening here in this call can start doing as of the end of this call, then that there are that leaders can influence.
I always feel like on one hand, leaders don't have the powers that we tend to assign to them. But on the other hand, the people don't always feel like taking the responsibility. They don't feel they can.
No, they're not willing to make the sacrifice.
Yes.
No, they're not willing to make the sacrifice. It's very simple. Yeah, but if I speak up, then what is my manager? Yeah, but if I give feedback, what are they? It all comes down. Are you willing to sacrifice things that you love? It could be your salary. It could be the perception that others have of you. Are you willing to sacrifice those things in order to act in a way that you know you should act if you want to be customer-centric?
And that's a really big challenge, because what we see a lot as customer experience leaders is that I and my team in CX may have the right intent and we may be willing to sacrifice, but we do rely on colleagues around the business. And more than anything, we rely on effective collaboration and working together towards delivering customer value. What if our colleagues don't see the appeal of this belief and are not willing to sacrifice their usual ways of working, the power they have, the matrix they're used to, the bonuses they adhere to, or whatever may be required? What can we do to engage them?
Well, why would you want to engage someone who doesn't believe in what you believe?
Because I want this organization to be more customer-centric, and I passionately believe that customer centricity is the right foundation for a good operating model.
Then, well, for one, and that also ties back to the first question, don't make any big communications about we are going to become a customer-centric organization. If you feel that most employees in your organization don't believe in it, or that the context, all the processes and the systems in the organization are really far away from customer centricity, don't make any big communications. People in the organization, they know what the organization is really about. And nobody likes false promises, at least I don't. And so behind the scenes somewhere, try to set up some initiatives, even without calling it customer-centric initiatives, but initiatives that you know will contribute to, because the terminology customer-centricity already triggers people. You know, from the moment the word drops, people have convictions. That's why I made the caveat on the Bible. From the moment the word drops, everybody has this immediate conviction and assumptions about it. Same is with customer centricity. So get rid of all the terminology and start taking the actions that you can take within the span of control of your job and your role in the organization that you know will contribute to customer-centric behavior. And then once you have some significant changes and results, then you can start talking about it more and say, hey, what do you think? And you can continue to invite them. What does not work, and history proves this, it doesn't work to impose a belief system on people. You just can't. All the things in the Middle East, we try to impose democracy on nations. It doesn't work. It has to come from an intrinsic motivation and an intrinsic value. And so ask the question, what makes me change my intrinsic motivation? It's listening, hearing peers saying, hey, but maybe you should take a look at it. So people that you trust, people that you trust give you examples. And you just have dialogue. You just share experiences without any judgment. It's okay that people don't believe in customer centricity. That's perfectly fine. I mean, it's not the holy grail. It's a way of organizing a company. So dialogue. I think I would summarize it. Facilitate dialogue. And that's also why I launched the Embossers Network and transformed from a consulting model to more a network model, is because we underestimate, for one, the power of dialogue in change initiatives. And within organizations, we always forget that phase. We immediately go into the action phase. But I think we forgot, and that's also a link with the Bible. These texts, as I mentioned, arose over thousands of years, and they are basically the essence of the collision of thousand years of different tribes and societies colliding with each other, and also their belief systems on what is a God, who's God, who is the real God, what does this God want from us? You know, all these ideas were constantly colliding and came into fruition into these texts, which was then their, you know, Bible. And the same counts for organizations. We need to have large-scale dialogues where ideas on where the organization should go can collide. And out of that collision comes the truth for that specific organization.
I love your perspective. It does. It absolutely does. And it for us and a lot of people in the audience, it's almost a revolution to hear it's okay not to be customer-centric, because, you know, we work in this space and we believe that this is the ultimate goal. But I hear what you're saying. It's one of the elements of an operating model. And who says that you're right in thinking that customer centricity is the most important one? Other people have their own belief that process may be the most important one, or technology, or people who deliver the whole thing, or leaders. And what we are trying to do is to bring everything into harmony. And therefore, we have no right, as you've pointed out, to impose our belief onto other people. We need to have a constructive dialogue. And before we dive deeper into this exploration, which I'm loving, I want us to explain a little bit, what is the Embossers Network? We are referring to this network very frequently. You and I love it, we know it, but maybe some of our listeners don't.
Yeah. Well, since we're also linking it with my theological discovery of the ancient biblical text, I'm going to try to make the same parallel with explaining what the Embossers Network. So in essence, the Embossers Network is a network of diverse companies. So diversity is key. Big companies, different industries, small companies, and the people that participate in the events and the things in our programs, they're also very diverse. So there's no one group with just CEOs or one group with just CIOs. No, it's a CEO, students from university, labor workers, machine workers. So a hugely diverse group. And the feedback that we always get is that this is extremely enlightening for the participants. And so what do they share? Because they're extremely diverse. And what do they share is a belief system. They all believe that our organizations need to become more transparent, more inclusive, more focused on the long term, and more relying on the autonomy of employees. So that's a shared belief system. But they also share a question. How do you do that? How do you go from a 200-year-old financial bank within a highly regulated context, basically the opposite of transparency and autonomy and freedom and etc. How do you go and make that evolution? And the honest answer is we don't know. We're trying to figure it out together, and that's what the Embossers Network is about. So the theme of each event is a very concrete challenge For example, there's a new European regulation coming that implies that organizations need to make their salary systems more transparent. Now, this is scary for many organizations. Often the people reply, when I say you need to make your salaries more transparent, the first thing they'll say is, that's going to create a lot of chaos, right? So that would be a very concrete challenge. And then we come together with a diverse group and we talk about, well, how could we make this more transparent? How could we approach this in an inclusive way? How would evaluation processes then look like once all the salary processes are transparent, and so on and so on. So we share a value system and we share that we have day-to-day challenges on how to implement this, how to live these values, let's say. So that's the Ambassadors Network. And basically, it's inspired by an insight that I got from my biblical studies. So in the year 300, and 326, I think, there's a Roman emperor, Constantine, who is conveyed to the teaching of Jesus. And he sets out a law that allows freedom of religion, including Christianity. And this was kind of the big paradigm shift from the ancient Roman culture towards the Roman Catholic culture. So this was the paradigm shift. And what preceded that paradigm shift was basically 300 years of small networks, small communities, mainly in the countryside in the Middle East, coming together where they were working, so at the water well, at the washing place, at where they ate, and just talking with each other what the teachings of this Jesus character meant in real life. And all those, the combination of all those communities and dialogues, that created ripple effects and ripple effects and ripple effects, which finally ended up to the main leader saying, okay, I'm going to adopt this belief system. You could argue if it was for the right reasons, because obviously politically he had a huge advantage. It's much more easy to create a unified empire if you have a religion with one god than a religion with multiple gods, because then by definition your empire is already separated. Some people prefer god number one and other people prefer god number two. You solve that problem with a monotheistic religion. So there was definitely also a political reason for it. That being said, the paradigm shift, which led to entirely new society and the foundations of what we now call our Western society, was led by 300 years of small communities trying to think of what these teachings mean in day-to-day life. And then 1,000 years later, and then I wrap up, we have the Enlightenment movement in Europe, which basically launched the French Revolution, which inspired the foundation of the United States. The symbol of the Enlightenment movement is still on the $1 bill. And again, this was preceded of decades of philosophers and all types of characters coming together, mainly in France, to talk about the ancient regime, which was a very absolute power, centralized power, and what was needed to shift that society. And again, it was the power of dialogue that led to some leaders picking up on this and saying, okay, I'm going to use my power to make some changes.
And for those in the audience who think that, oh, of course, NIC is based in the Netherlands, in Belgium, sorry, and it only applies to Northern Europe because they are all very collaborative and willing to talk to each other, I can reassure you it doesn't, because NIC shared with me some amazing case studies with unbossing Chinese steel manufacturers and his inspiration from India in Jaipur rugs. You can find all of these examples on CX Panda, or you can reach out to Nick later on and talk more about this. It does apply across the world, but a lot of companies still execute this command and control mentality. And one of the questions from the audience, from Elena, is quite right. Is it even possible for modern companies to be fully human-centric? The companies are built to erase human characters because it's hard to manage humans. What's your view?
So, yes. And that's a religious belief. I cannot prove that. But I do believe that at some point in time, we will create organizations like the Garden of Eden, which was basically the definition of success by the biblical authors. How they saw a successful world was a world where nature flourishes and where humans and plants and animals live in harmony together. And so, yeah, I do believe that we as humans are on a journey to reach that point. And if you look at history, it goes in phases. So if you look at biblical times, you had basically the dominance of the Egyptians, the Babylonians, who had a very rigid top-down structure and obviously implement and abuse slavery at a huge scale. And then you had this belief system, this idea on a more inclusive human-centric society that arose from the Israelites and was taken further by Jesus, that had an impact, a huge impact. But then there was a new phase, the Middle Ages, and then in France in the 16th, 17th century, we had the Sun King, I think that's in English, so Louis XIV, who was again the epiphany of centralized power, and all the rest was just slaves. And then we had the Enlightenment movement, and out of the Enlightenment movement came the Industrial Revolution and all the wealth that came with that in the 19th and 20th century. And I think now more and more people are starting to realize that our companies are getting again more and more centralized in terms of power, more and more institutionalized, more and more bureaucracy. And there will be a new phase which will break this down and take our society and our organizations again a level up in terms of human centricity. What I had to learn, to wrap up, is to let go of the idea that this should happen in my lifetime. Because this is an evolution that goes across generations. And so rather than, for a long time, I was quite judgmental and dogmatic, like, oh, all the organizations who are not doing this, who are not human-centric, they're bad. No, they're not. They're all part of the same journey. And if the only thing I can do is try to embody human centricity in the things I say and in the things I do and in the decisions I make, and as such, maybe inspire someone else to do the same. And I do believe there's a new phase. I see a lot of people in many different organizations who are on this journey with me, and setting off a new phase in this evolution.
As humble as this purpose sounds, I think it's much more powerful than trying to change the world, and as perhaps more rewarding, because you do see a lot of people following the invitation to dialogue and potentially changing their organizations. And as Anna says here, with your leadership, you are accepting higher standards of accountability. And in modern organizations, we may have forgotten this a little bit. It's almost like, you know, I don't have to have the accountability if I'm not making sacrifices. I don't have to lead, I can manage. And Thomas points out that readiness to sacrifice is the difference between bosses and leaders. and touches on the concept of servant leadership. And oh. I know in the past we've discussed the reverse pyramid, and I love the example of Thomson's in the UK, where the CEO and the founder said, I'm here to enable people who serve the customers. So I'm the bottom of the pyramid. The top of the pyramid are the people who interact with customers all the time and only have two rules for them. You have to serve the customer and you have to put the money in the till. The rest, you take breaks when you want. You say what you want because I believe in you and I believe you're going to do the right thing. And tell us what you need from the organization to enable you to serve the customers in the best possible way. What's your take on servant leadership?
Yeah, so if we talk about the pyramid, I feel it's so important that people understand how powerful and ancient that symbol is and why visualizing our organization as a pyramid is not something trivial. And so do I have 2 minutes to explain that?
Of course.
Yeah.
Yes.
So the pyramid is a representation of a mountain. In every culture, not just in the biblical culture, in any culture in the world, since the beginning of humanity, mountains have a very special meaning in the way that we humans understand and structure our worlds and structure what is valuable and meaningful. And so in a way, mountains are where heaven meets earth, or in other words, where potential meets our reality. And so, for example, the Garden of Eden, which is the definition of success, a successful world in the biblical stories, it's not a coincidence that it's at the top of the mountain. What we position at the top of the mountain is what we define as successful. It's the highest form of success, of meaning, of value. It's where reality meets our fullest potential. Okay? So if you now grasp that concept and you put it in the context of organizations, the first thing that people get when you onboard is a presentation of the pyramid, a symbol that is so ancient that it's integrated in our DNA. Without that we even know it, it influences the way we look at the world. And what do we see in the pyramid? We see the CEO at the top. So basically, both consciously and subconsciously, we are constantly messaging in the organization that the CEO is the highest value of success. It's the highest form of meaning. And therefore, all career development tracks are directed, and also our universities are directed to get to that place. By the way, we also see it in another Olympic athletes, for example. They sacrifice their entire life to get to the top of the stage with the golden medal. Okay, so that's another example. And so the message that we constantly get is that the highest form of success in our organization, the reason why you need to make sacrifices is because you need to get to that role. That's also the reason why people, even though they're not in the management team, but close to the management team, they say very proudly, yeah, I'm close to the management team. Because that says something about our interpretation of meaning and value. It's as if it's something very meaningful to be close to the top. So if we talk about flipping the pyramid, I am not talking about flipping the structure of the pyramid, right? The top can still be the top and the bottom is still the top, the bottom. But we need to change the definition of success at the top. The definition of success at the top should be a fulfilled consumer or customer and a sustainable relationship between the people who are in direct contact with the customer and becoming masters in serving the customer. And so the definition of success should not be developing yourself in managing people and resources, No, the career development success should be becoming better and better and mastering yourself in serving customer needs. And then you have the foundation of the pyramid, and that's where servant leadership comes from. Typically, if you think about the Egyptians, you had the pharaoh at the top and the servants at the bottom. What servant leadership means is that you sacrifice the identity, the recognition, the status, the rewards of being at the top. You sacrifice that to become the shoulders on which the pyramid stands and become a servant leadership leader. And what you get in return for those sacrifices is obviously meaning, impact, fulfillment, much more than in the old model.
Very inspiring. And as Elena says, this is probably a topic for a whole book, which Nick has written. Read the book.
Yeah, you kind of get me going now. So don't hesitate to stop me, or if I'm talking too much, let me know, because
I guess what I'm trying to get my head around, and we've also asked this question with the audience, is a lot of organizations are not built like that. There will be complexities in the journey, and autonomy comes at a price, as you say, sacrifices. There will be mistakes. So how can we reassure leaders and those who lead without authority included, to build this right autonomy and reward system to encourage customer-centric behavior, to encourage the right beliefs?
So first and foremost, we shouldn't be too harsh on ourselves. Most organizations, since the origin of organizations, were not built like that. That's why it's the Garden of Eden. I truly believe it's in our potential, and we're simply not there yet. And that's partially my own responsibility, because I also sometimes fail to embody the behavior and the speech and the decisions that are required to get there. You know, we're all flawed human beings in a way. That being said, what I do feel is that we need to try to create within the span of control that we have, and this span of control can be different for everyone listening. It could be just you and your coworkers. It could be you and your department of 100 people. It could be you and your company of 1,000 people. So everybody has a different span of control. But within that span, I believe we should try to create an organization where everybody experiences flow. Are you familiar with the concept of flow?
I can stipulate what it means, but please tell us in your own words.
Well, I think it's all our shared responsibility to create an environment. And again, the scope of the environment depends on who you are and what your possibilities are. But a context of flow is one where you and your coworkers work with heart and soul, and where everyone finds themselves in the optimal zone between the challenge that you have and the skills that you have. And as such, work becomes effortless and fulfilling. And the first step is to make sure that you create a context in which that applies to you. And once you're there, you can start inviting other people to join you. And I think it's interesting, I suppose we're getting to the end of this conversation. The concept of flow was first described by a psychologist whose name is extremely difficult to pronounce, but I wrote it down here. So Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi. I can't do it better than that. He's the founder of the positive psychology movement, and he describes five elements that are required to experience flow. And I think it's interesting to list them, And everyone can judge for themselves to which extent their workspace, meets these criteria. Okay. So the first element is that you are able to regularly and deeply concentrate on your work. So if you find yourself constantly changing, chasing emails, meetings, deadlines, then chances are you will have difficulties getting into a state of flow. The second one is clear goals, rewards, and immediate feedback. So regular concentration, clear goals, clear rewards, immediate feedback. The third one is that you find intrinsic value in your work experience. So the act of getting up to work and to go to work, standing in traffic to go to work, meeting with your colleagues, having lunch with your colleagues, getting your work tasks done, the act itself should be intrinsically valuable to you, despite of the results, positive or negative. Right? That's the third element. The fourth element is that there's a nice balance between the challenges that you face and the skills that you have. If your challenges, the difficulty of the challenges exceeds your skill set, you will panic. If the skill set exceeds the difficulty of the challenges, you will become lazy and apathetic and bored. And the last one is that you have a sense of self-control in your work. So regular concentration, clear goals, rewards, and immediate feedback, intrinsic value in your work experience, nice balance between challenge and skills, and a sense of having self-control over your work. And the positive news for everyone listening is that you have a lot of power. No matter in which, even if you work in the most top-down, not customer-centric organization, you have a lot of power to influence each of these elements within the context of your own work and your own team.
This will be my key takeaway to navigate the doubts and sacrifices on the path to business harmony. Would you suggest, in addition to this one big takeaway consisting of five, really, would you suggest your top three things that people should do to be more confident on their journey to Eden?
Yeah. So three words. Oh, no. In English, it's more.
It's a bit more in English. You just have more letters.
Take care of others. Four words. Put your entire attention span to caring for others. What I've learned, and as I mentioned in my introduction, so until my personal low point, I've did so many development, personal development and coaching things. And there was so much attention on my feelings, my emotions, how I'm feeling, my trauma, blah, 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 blah. So much emotion, attention on myself. And at a certain point, I shifted my attention in trying to help people around me who I can help. And making the sacrifices that I needed to make in order to be able to help them. And what I found was that I, as a person, I grew exponentially and I learned much, much more about myself in doing that than in all the years where I was meditating and reflecting on myself and thinking about my skills and thinking about this. I was just going into action, making the sacrifices and trying to care for other people. And in essence, that's what customer centricity is. It's a caring culture. You just really, really, really care for someone else, and you make them more important than yourself. You make their ideas more important than your own ideas. You make their needs more important than your needs. And I think that would be my key takeaway. Start focusing all your attention on caring for others, and both externally as internally. Beautiful. It's a tough journey. It's really, really tough. Every day I fail. Try again. It sounds so simple, and yet it's really difficult, but also very enriching.
Thank you, Nick. It's inspirational as always, useful as always. Thank you for sharing all of the examples with us, your thoughts on how the spiritual and the business worlds connect. We see a lot of connections, all the practical tips. Thank you for sharing your time with us today. And for anybody attending or listening to this conversation, please feel free to reach out to myself or Nick if you have any thoughts, comments, questions, or challenges for us. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.